but he sure didn't like it. He said something in a short, curt tone.
"My lord demands to know why you are here," the priestess said.
"Tell him he fucking well knows why I'm here," I said. She stared at me in shock. She stammered several times as she translated for me. I don't know if ancient Mayan has a word for bleep or if she used it. The Red King listened, his expression slipping from displeasure into careful neutrality. He stared at me for several moments before he spoke again.
"I was given a gift by she you know as Duchess Ariana," the girl translated. "Are you saying that the gift was wrongfully obtained?"
"Yes," I said, not looking away from him. "And you know it." I shook my head. "I'm sick of dancing. Tell him that I'll kill Ariana for him, take my daughter with me, and leave in peace. Tell him if he does that, it stops being personal. Otherwise, I'm prepared to fight." The girl translated, her face once more fearful. When she finished, the Red King burst out laughing. He leaned back against the altar, his mouth wide in a grin, his black eyes utterly unsettling. He spoke a few terse sentences.
"My lord says that he will throw one of your limbs from each door if you lift your hand against him."
I snorted. "Yes, but I won't even try to kill him." I leaned forward, speaking to the Red King, not the girl, and showing him my teeth. "I'll try to cripple him, wound him, weaken him. Ask him if he thinks the death curse of a wizard of the White Council can deal him a wound. Ask him how well he trusts the people on the nearest couple of levels of the pyramid. Ask him if he thinks that they'll visit and send gifts when they realize he's been hurt."
Alamaya spoke in a fearful whisper, earning a sharp word of reproof and a command from the Red King. I guessed at the subject matter.
"I don't want to tell you this, my lord."
"Stupid slave, translate the way I damn well told you to do, or I'll break my foot off in your ass." Okay, maybe not that last part. Alamaya got on with her unpleasant job, and the words pushed the Red King into a rage. He gritted his teeth, and things moved beneath his skin, shifting and rolling where nothing should have existed that could shift and roll. I stared at him with one eyebrow lifted and that same wolf smile on my face, waiting for his reaction. He hadn't been talked to like this in a long time, if ever. He might not have much of a coping mechanism for dealing with it. If he didn't, I was going to die really horribly. He did. He mastered himself, but I thought it was close, and it cost the woman on the altar her life. He spun and slammed the obsidian knife into her right eye with such force that it broke off. She arched her body up as much as her restraints allowed and let out a short, choked scream of agony, throwing her head left and right, and then she sort of slowly relaxed into death. One leg kept twitching and moving. The Red King ran two fingertips through the blood that was seeping from her eye socket. He slipped the fingers into his mouth and shuddered. Then he turned to face me, completely composed again.
I'd seen behavior like that before. It was the mark of an addict scoring a fix and full of contentment that he had a body full of booze or drugs or whatever, and therefore the illusion that he could handle emotional issues more capably. That explained a lot about how the Red Court had behaved during the war. Hell's bells. Their king was a junkie. No wonder they'd performed so inconsistently, brilliant and aggressive one moment, capable of making insane and idiotic mistakes the next. It also explained why there was strife within the court. If the mark of power was control over one's bloodthirst, indulging it only when and where one chose, and not with every random impulse, then anyone who knew about the Red King's condition would know that he was weak, inconsistent, and irrational. Hell's bells. This guy wasn't just a monster. He was also paranoid. He had to be, because he knew that his bloodlust would be seen as a sign that he should be overthrown. If it had been happening for very long, it would have driven him insane. Even for one of the Red Court, I mean. And that must be what had happened. Ariana had somehow tumbled to the Red King's weakness and was building a power base aimed at deposing him. She'd be building her own power, personal, political, and social, inasmuch as the vampires had a psychotic, blood-spattered, axe-murdering version of a society. Dealing appropriately with one's enemies was critical to maintaining standing in any society. And for the Red Court, the only two enemies were those who had been dealt with appropriately and those who were still alive. She literally had no choice but to take me down if she was to succeed. And a Pearl Harbor for the White Council wouldn't hurt her any either if she pulled it off. Oh, I had to make sure this little lunatic stayed king. As long as he was, the Council would never face a competent, united Red Court. The Red King spoke a moment later and wiped off his fingers in Alamaya's hair as he did. My lord accepts your petition to challenge the Duchess. This slave will be sent to fetch her while you wait. Not so fast, I said as Alamaya began to rise. Tell him I want to see the girl. She froze between us, wide-eyed. The king moved a hand in a permissive gesture. She spoke quietly to him. His lip twitched up away from his teeth a couple of times, but he gave me a curt nod and gestured at the altar. Then he stepped to one side and watched me. I kept track of him out of the corner of my eye as I approached the altar. Maggie, wearing little metal restraints that had been made to fit children, huddled on the far side of the altar. Blood had spilled out, and she had retreated from it until she was pressed against the wall, trying to keep her little shoes and dress, both filthy already, out of the blood. Her hair was a tangled mess. Her dark eyes were wide and bloodshot. She was shivering. It wasn't terribly cold out tonight, but it was cold enough to torment a child, dressed in only a little cotton dress. I wanted to go to her, take those restraints off, wrap her up in my ridiculous cloak and get her some food and some hot chocolate and a bath and a comb and a brush and a teddy bear and a bed and a... She saw me and flinched away with a whimper. Oh, God. I ached seeing her there, frightened and miserable and alone. I know how to handle pain when I'm the one feeling it. But the hurt that went through me upon seeing my child, my blood, suffering there in front of my eyes, it went to a whole new level, and I had no idea how to deal with it. But I thought it would probably start with tearing some more vampires to bloody shreds. I took that pain and fed it to the storm inside me, the one that had been raging for endless hours, and that flared up white hot again. I waited until my rage had been stoked hot enough to dry the tears in my eyes. Then I turned to the Red King and nodded. Deal, I said. Go get the Duchess. I'll take out the garbage for you. Chapter 44 Alamaya departed the temple in silence. Within a minute she was back. She bowed to the Red King, a full, kneeling bow at that, and said something quietly. The Red King narrowed his eyes. He murmured something to the girl and walked out. Conch horns blew, and the drums began again as he appeared to those outside. Alamaya had to raise her voice slightly to be heard. My lord wishes you to know that this place is watched and warded. Should you attempt to leave with a child, you will be destroyed, and she with you. Understood, I said calmly. Alamaya gave me a more conventional bow and hurried out after the Red King. When she was gone, I took two steps over to the altar and the dead woman upon it. Then I said, All right, tell me what I'm looking at. From the improvised Rolling Stones t-shirt bag tied to my sash, Bob the Skull said, in his most caustic voice, A giant pair of cartoon lips. I muttered a curse and fumbled with the shirt until one of the skull's glowing orange eye sockets was visible. A big, goofy magic nerd, Bob said. I growled at him and aimed his eye at the altar. Oh, Bob said. Oh, my. What is it? I asked. The ritual curse they're setting up, Bob said. It's a big one. How does it work, in 10 seconds or less? Ugh, Bob said. Okay. Picture a crossbow. All the human sacrifices are the effort you need to pull back the string and store the energy. This crossbow has its string all the way back, and it's ready to fire. It just needs a bolt.
What do you mean, a bolt?
Like the little girl hiding back behind it, Bob said. Her blood will carry the stored energy out into the world and conduct that energy to the target. In this case, her blood relatives.
I frowned for a second, then I asked, does it have to be Maggie, specifically?
Nah, one bolt is pretty much like another. Long as you use a compatible knife to spill the blood, it should work.
I nodded.
So, what if we used a different bolt?
The same thing would happen, Bob said. The only difference would be who was on the receiving end.
It's a loaded gun, I said, quietly. I frowned.
Then why'd they leave me alone with it?
Who are you gonna kill to set it off? Bob asked. Your little girl? Yourself? Come on, boss.
Can we disarm it then? Scramble it?
Sure. It'd blow this temple halfway to orbit, but you could do that.
I ground my teeth. If it goes off the way they mean it to, will it kill Thomas?
The girl's human, Bob said. So, only the human bits. His body, his mind. I suppose if he got lucky, he might wind up a vegetable in which his hunger demon was trapped. But it won't spread any farther into the White Court than that.
Damn it, I said.
I started to say more, but caught motion out of the corner of my eye.
I stuffed Bob all the way back into the sack, admonishing him to shut up, and turned to find Alamaya entering the temple with a dozen of the full vampire jaguar warriors at her back.
If you would follow me, Lord Wizard, the girl said, I will conduct you to she who has wronged you. My lord wishes you to know that he gives his word that your daughter will be spared from any harm until the duel is concluded.
Thank you, I said. I turned to look at my little girl one more time. She huddled against the wall, her eyes open but not fixed on anything, as if she were trying to watch everything around her at once. I moved over to the child, and she flinched again. I knelt down in front of her. I didn't try to touch her. I didn't think I would be able to keep cool if I saw her recoil from my hand.
Maggie, I said quietly.
Her eyes flashed up to me, surprise evident there.
I'm going to take you away from the mean people, I said, keeping my voice as soft and gentle as I knew how. I didn't know if she even understood English.
Okay? I'm taking you out of here.
Her lip trembled. She looked away from me again. Then I stood up and followed the priestess of the junky god to face my enemy. Outside, things had changed. The Red Court had filed down from the pyramid and were on the move, walking in calm, ordered procession to another portion of the ruins. My companions waited at the bottom of the stairs.
Right, I said, once I reached them. Duel time.
Sonya shook his head. Mark my words, this will not be settled in a dueling circle. Things like this always go to hell.
The accords are serious, I said. He'll play it straight. If I win, I get the girl, and we're gone.
Martin shook his head.
What? I asked him.
I know them, he said levelly. None of us are leaving this place alive.
His words had an instant effect on everyone. They hit Molly the hardest. She was already pale. I saw her swallow nervously.
Maybe you know the monsters, Martin, Murphy said quietly. But I know the guy who stops them. And if they don't return the girl, we'll make them regret it.
She nodded at me and said, Let's go. We can watch Dresden kill the bitch. I found myself smiling. Murphy was good people.
Once the last of the half-mortal jaguar warriors had departed, we fell into step behind them and followed them toward what looked like another temple on the north end of the ruins. As we went beneath the temple doorway, though, we found ourselves passing through it into the open space beyond, a swath of green grass at least 150 yards long and 70 or 80 yards wide. Stone walls about 30 feet high lined the long sides of the rectangle, while the far end boasted a temple like the one we'd just entered.
It's a stadium, I murmured, looking around the place.
Ugh, Molly said. There are some pretty horrific stories about the Mayan spectator sports, boss.
Indeed, Leah sighed happily. They knew well how to motivate their athletes.
Alamaya turned to me and said, Lord, your retainers may wait here. Please come with me. Keep your eyes open, folks, I said. Then I nodded to Alamaya and followed her onto the field. Even as I started out, a woman started walking toward me from the opposite end. As she approached, I saw that Ariana had the same facial features, more or less, but she had traded in her pale skin for red-brown, her icy eyes for vampire black, and she'd dropped 6 inches from her height. She wore a simple buckskin shift and more gold jewelry than a Mr. T look-alike convention. Her nose was a little sharper, a little longer, but as we stopped and faced each other from about 10 feet away, I could see the hate boiling behind her eyes. I had no doubt that this was the Duchess. I smiled at her and said, I gotcha now. Yes, Ariana replied. Her eyes flicked up and around us in a quick circle, taking in the thousands of members of the Red Court and their retainers. I may faint with terror. Why? I demanded of her. Why bring the child into this? Why not just come straight to me? Does it matter at this point? I shrugged. Not really. I'm curious. She stared at me for a moment, and then she smiled.
You don't know.
I eyed her warily. Don't know what?
Dear boy, she said. This was never about you.
I scowled. I don't understand.
Obviously, Ariana said, and gave me a stunning smile. Die confused.
A conch horn moaned, and Alamaya turned to bow toward the temple I'd just come through. I could see the Red King seated upon a throne made of dark, richly polished wood, decorated with golden filigree and designs. Alamaya rose and turned to us. Lord and Lady, these are the limits within which you must do battle. First, I scowled. Hey, this is an accords matter. We abide by the Code Duello. The Red King spoke, and though he was more than 200 feet away, I heard him clearly. Alamaya listened and bowed.
My lord replies that this is a holy time and holy ground to our people, and has been from time immemorial. If you do not wish to respect the traditions of our people, he invites you to return tomorrow night. Unfortunately, he can make no promises about the fate of his newest chattel, should you choose to do so.
I eyed the Red King, then I snorted. Fine, I said. Alamaya nodded and continued.
First, she said, as you are both wielders of power, you will duel with power and power alone. Physical contact of any kind is forbidden.
Ariana's eyes narrowed. Mine did, too. I knew that the Red Court had dabblers in magic. Hell, the first Red Court vampire I'd ever met had been a full-blown sorceress by the time she'd been elevated to the Red Court's nobility. Judging by Ariana's jewelry, her proper place had been on the 11th tier of the pyramid, the one directly below the Lords of Outer Night themselves. It stood to reason that even a dabbler could have accrued way too much experience and skill over the course of millennia.
Second, the mortal priestess said, your persons and whatsoever power you use must be contained within the walls of this court. Should either of you violate that prescription, you will be slain out of hand by the wills of my lord and the lords of Outer Night.
I have this problem with buildings, I said. Maybe you noticed the columns back the other way? Alamaya gave me a blank look. I sighed. Nobody appreciates levity when they're in the middle of their traditional mumbo-jumbo, I guess. Nothing, never mind.
Third, Alamaya said, the duel will begin at the next sounding of the conch. It will end only when one of you is no more. Do you understand the rules as I have given them to you?
Yep, I said.
Yes, said Ariana.
Have you anything else to say? Always, I said, but it can wait. Ariana smiled slightly at me.
Give my father my thanks, and tell him that I will join him in the temple momentarily.
Alamaya bowed to us both. Then she retreated from the field and back over to her boss. The night grew silent. Down in the stadium, There wasn't even the sound of wind. The silence gnawed at me, though Ariana looked relaxed.
So, I said, your dad is the Red King.
Indeed, he created me, as he created all of the 13 and the better part of our nobility.
One big, blood-sucking Brady Bunch, huh? But I'll bet he missed all the PTA meetings.
The Duchess studied me and shook her head.
I shall never understand why someone hasn't killed you before now.
Wasn't for lack of trying, I said.
Hey, why do you suppose he set up the rules the way he did?
If we'd gone by the code duello, there's a chance it could have been limited to a physical confrontation. Really seems to be taking away most of your advantages, doesn't he?
She smiled.
A jaded person might consider it a sign of his weakness.
Nice spin on that one. Purely out of curiosity, though.
Once you kill me, what comes next?
She lifted her shoulders in a shrug. I continue to serve the Red Court to the best of my ability.
I showed her my teeth.
Meaning you're going to knock Big Red out of that chair, right?
That is more ambitious than reasonable, she said. One of the 13, I should think, will ascend to become Kukulkan.
Creating an opening in the Lords of Outer Night, I said, getting it. Murdering your father to get a promotion. You're all class.
Cattle couldn't possibly understand.
Couldn't understand that Daddy's losing it? I asked.
That he's reverting into one of your blood slaves?
Her mouth twitched, as if she were restraining it from twisting into a snarl. It happens, betimes to the aged, Ariana said. I love and revere my father, but his time is done.
Unless you lose, I said.
I find that unlikely.
She looked me up and down.
What a novel outfit. I wore it especially for you, I said, and fluttered my eyelashes at her.
She didn't look amused.
Most of what I do is business, impersonal, but I'm going to enjoy this.
I dropped the wiseacre attitude. The growing force of my anger burned it away.
Taking my kid isn't impersonal, I said. It's a Kevorkian-esque cry for help.
Such moral outrage.
Yet you were as guilty as I. Did you not slay Paolo's child, Bianca? Bianca was trying to kill me at the time, I said. Maggie is an innocent. She couldn't possibly hurt you.
Then you should have considered that before you insulted me by murdering my grandchild, she hissed, her voice suddenly tight and cold. I am patient, wizard, more patient than you could imagine. And I have looked forward to this day when the consequences of your arrogance shall fall upon both you and all who love you.
The threat lit a fire in my brain, and I thought the anger was going to tear its way free of my chest and go after her without me.
Bitch, I spat. Come get some.
The horn blew. Chapter 45. Both of us had been gathering up our wills during the snark-off, and the first instant of the duel nearly killed us both. I called forth force and fire, both laced with a soul fire that would help reinforce its reality, making the attack more difficult to negate or withstand. It took the shape of a sphere of blue-white fire the size of an inflatable exercise ball. Meanwhile, Ariana fluttered her hands in an odd twisting gesture, and a geyser of water erupted from the soil with bone-crushing force. The two attacks met halfway between us, with results neither of us could prevent. Fire and water turned to scalding hot steam in a detonation that instantly washed back over us both. My shield bracelet was ready to go, and a situation something like this one, that had rendered my left hand into a horror prop, had inspired me to be sure I could protect myself from this kind of heat in the future. I leapt back and landed in a crouch, raising the shield into a complete dome around me as the cloud of steam swept down, its heat boiling the grass as it came. It stayed there for several seconds before beginning to disperse, and when it finally did, I couldn't see Ariana anywhere on the field. I kept the all-around shield in place for a moment and rapidly focused upon a point, a little bit above and midway between my eyebrows.
I called up my sight and swept my gaze around the stadium to see Ariana 40 yards away and running to put herself in position to shoot me in the back. A layer of greasy black magic seemed to infest the air around her, the veil that my physical eyes hadn't been able to see. To my sight, she was a Red Court vampire in its true form, only even more flabby and greasy than a normal vamp, a creature ancient in power and darkness. I tried not to see anything else, but there was only so much I could do. I could see the deaths that had been heaped upon this field over centuries, lingering in a layer of translucent bones that covered the ground to a depth of 3 or 4 feet. In the edges of my vision, I could see the grotesqueries that were the true appearance of the Red Court, every one of them a unique and hideous monster according to his particular madness. I didn't dare look directly up at the spectators, and especially not those gathered on the second floor of the little temple at the end of the stadium. I didn't want to look at the Red King and his lords unveiled. I kept my gaze moving, as if I hadn't spotted Ariana on the prowl, and kept turning in a circle, timing when my back was going to be exposed to her before I dropped the shield and rose, panting, as if I couldn't have held it any longer than that. I kept on turning, and an instant before she would have released her spell, I whirled on her, pointed a finger, and snarled, "Forzare!" Raw will lashed out and exploded against her chest, just before the flickers of electricity she'd gathered could congeal into a real stroke of lightning. It threw her 20 feet back and slammed her against the ancient rock wall along the side of the ball court. Before she could fall, I looked up at the top of the wall, seized a section of large stones in fingers of unseen will, and raked them out of their resting places so that they plunged 30 feet down toward Ariana. She was superhumanly quick, of course. Anyone mortal would have been crushed. She got away with only a glancing blow from one of the smaller stones and darted to the side, rolling a sphere of lurid red light into a ball between her hands as she went. I didn't want to be on the receiving end of that, whatever it was. So I kept raking at the wall over and over again, bringing down dozens of the stones and forcing her to keep moving, while I ran parallel to her and kept our spacing static. We were both slinging magic on the run, but she had more one-on-one experience than me. Like a veteran gunslinger in the Old West, she took her time lining up her shot, while I flailed away at her with rushed actions that had little chance to succeed. All told, I must have dropped several dozen tons of rock down onto her as we ran, inflicting nothing worse than a few abrasions and heavy bruises. She threw lightning at me once. The world flashed red-white, and something hard hit me in the back. My legs went wobbly, and I sat there for a subjective hour, stunned, and realized that whatever she had packed her lightning bolt with, it had been sufficient to throw me twice as far as my heavy punch had thrown her. I'd bounced off the opposite wall. I looked down at myself, expecting to see a huge hole with burned edges, and instead found a black smudge on my overdone breastplate, and a couple of flaws in the gold filigree where the metal had partially melted. I was alive. My head came back together in a sudden rush, and I knew what was coming. I flung up my shield, shaping it not into a portion of a sphere, as I usually did, but into a lengthy triangle in the shape of a pup tent. I crouched beneath it, and no sooner had I done so than stones from the wall above me, torn free by Ariana's will, began to slam into the shield. I crouched there, rapidly being buried in gray stone, and tried desperately to get my impact-dizzied brain to think of a plan. The best I came up with under the circumstances was this. What would Yoda do? There was a tiny moment between one rock falling and the next, and I dropped the shield. As the next rock began to fall, I stretched out my hand and my will, catching it before gravity could give it much velocity. Again I screamed, "Forzare!" And with an enormous effort of will, I altered the course of the stone's fall, flinging it as hard as I could at Ariana, abetted by gravity and the remnants of her own magic. She saw it coming, but not until it was too late. She lifted her hands, her fingers making warding gestures as she brought her own defensive magic to bear. The stone smashed through it in a flash of reddish light and then struck her in the hip, spinning her about wildly and sending her to the ground.
"Harry Dresden, human catapult," I screamed drunkenly.
Ariana was back on her feet again in an instant. Her shield had bled enough of the energy from the stone to prevent it from smashing into her with lethal force, but it had bought me enough time to get out of the pile of rocks around me and away from the stadium wall. I smashed at her with more fire, and she parried each shaft deftly, congealing water out of the air into wobbling spheres that intercepted the bolts of flame and exploded into concealing steam. By the fifth or sixth bolt, I couldn't see her with my physical eyes, but I did see energies in motion behind the steam as she pulled another dark sheath of veiling energy around her, and I saw her take off into an animal swift sprint, again circling me to attack me from behind. No, she couldn't be trying the same thing twice. Duels between wizards are about more than swatting each other with various forms of energy, just as boxing is about more than throwing hard punches. There is an art to it, a science to it, in which one attempts to predict the other's attack and counter it effectively. You had to imagine a counter to what the opponent might do and have it ready to fly at an instant's notice. Similarly, you had to imagine your way around the strength of his defenses. A duel of magic is determined almost purely by the imaginations and raw power of those involved. Ariana had obviously prepared against my favorite weapon, fire, which was only intelligent. But she had tried this backstabbing ploy on me once before and nearly got burned doing it. A wizard of any experience would tell you that she would never have tried that one again, for fear that the enemy would exploit it even further. Ariana was an experienced killer, but she hadn't done a lot of dueling with nothing to rely on except her magic. She'd always had the cushion of her extraordinary strength and speed to fall back upon. Hell, it would have been the smart way to kill me. Come straight in, shedding attacks and maybe taking some hits to get close enough to end it decisively. Except here, she couldn't, and she wasn't adjusting well to the handicap. Flexibility of thought is almost never a strength of the truly ancient monsters of the world. Instead of obliging her by standing in place, as I had last time she tried to give me the runaround, I darted forward into the edges of the concealing steam. I got burned and accepted it as the price of doing business. I clenched my teeth, focusing past my pain, and tracked Ariana's energy with my sight, waiting for my shot and hoping that she didn't have the sight as well. Apparently she didn't, or wasn't bothering to use it, relying upon her superior senses instead. She got into position and seemed to realize that I'd gone into the steam. She began to advance cautiously, gathering more lightning to her cupped hands. I saw the instant in which she began to spot my outline, the way she drew a breath to speak a word to unleash the lightning upon me.
Infriga!
I hissed and threw both hands forward.
Infriga forzare!
And the entire cloud bank of steam in the air around me congealed into needle-pointed spears of ice that flew at her as if fired from a gun. They struck her just as she unleashed her lightning bolt, which shattered one of the spears and tore a 2-foot furrow in the dirt some 20 feet to my side. Ariana stood still for a moment, her black eyes wide with disbelief, staring down at the spears and shards of ice that had slammed deep into her flesh. She looked up at me for a second and opened her mouth. A blob of black blood burst out and spilled down over her chin. Then she shuddered and fell, simply limp, to the ground. From the far end of the ball court, I heard my godmother throw back her head and let out an eerie howl of excitement and triumph, bubbling with laughter and scorn. I watched Ariana twisting upon the spears of ice. She'd been pierced in dozens of places. The worst hit came from an icicle as thick as my forearm, which had impaled her through the belly and come out the back, bursting the blood reservoir of the creature beneath Ariana's flesh mask. The pure, crystalline clear ice showed a glimpse of her insides, as if seen through a prism. She gasped a word I didn't recognize, over and over. I didn't know what language it was, but I knew what it meant.
No, 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 no.
I stood over her for a moment. She struggled to bring some other form of magic to bear against me, but the cruel torment of those cold spears was a pain she had never experienced, and did not know how to fight. I stared down at the creature that had taken my daughter, and felt... I felt only a cold, calm satisfaction, whirling like a blizzard of snow and sleet in the storm of my wrath. She stared up at me with uncomprehending eyes, black blood staining her mouth.
Cattle, you are cattle.
Moo, I said, and I lifted my right hand. Her eyes widened further. She gasped a word I didn't know. From the corner of my eye, I saw the Red King rise from his distant throne. I poured all that was left of my fury into my hand and snarled,
No one touches my little girl!
The explosion of force and fire tore a crater in the ground 7 feet across and half as deep. Ariana's broken, headless corpse lay sprawled within it. Silence fell over the ruined city. I turned toward the Red King and started walking that way. I stopped on what would have been the 10-yard line in a football stadium and faced him. Now give me my daughter, I said. He stared at me, bleak and remote as a far mountain. And then he smiled and said in perfect English, I think not. I clenched my teeth.
We had a deal.
He looked at me with uncaring eyes and said, I never spoke a word to you. A god does not converse or bargain with cattle. He uses and dispenses with them as he sees fit. You have served your purpose, and I have no further use for you or the mewling child. I snarled.
You promised that she would not be harmed.
Until after the duel, he said, and sycophantic chuckles ran through the vampires all around me. It is after the duel. He turned his head to one side and said to one of the jaguar warrior vampires in his retinue, Go, kill the child. I almost got the Red King while his head was turned, but some instinct seemed to warn him at the last instant, and he ducked. The bolt of flame I'd hurled at him blew the jaguar warrior vamp's jaw off of his head and set him on fire. He fell back, stumbling and screaming, his monstrous form tearing free of his mask of flesh. The Red King whirled toward me in a fury, and those black eyes pressed down upon me with all the crushing weight of the ages. I was driven to my knees by a blanket of pure will, and not just will, but horrible pain. Pain that originated not in my body, but in the nerves themselves. Pain I was helpless to resist. I heard someone scream,
Harry!
And saw the masked figures upon the temple with the Red King step forward. A gun went off and someone screamed. I heard a bellow and looked up to see my friends and my godmother facing the masked lords of outer night. Sonya was on his feet, but motionless, grimly clutching Esperachios in both hands. Murphy was on one knee and had dropped her P90. One hand was moving slowly, determinedly, toward the sword on her back. Martin was on the ground. I couldn't see any of the others. I couldn't turn my head far enough, but nobody was up to fighting. None of us could move beneath the horrible pressure of will of the Red King and the lords about her knight.
Insolent beast, snarled the Red King. Die in agony.
He seized another guard by his jaguar skin and jerked him close, as if the brawny vampire had been a child.
Need I repeat myself?
He seethed, and shoved his blood-stained ritual knife into the warrior's hands.
Place that child upon the altar and kill her.
Chapter 46. Guys like the Red King just don't know when to shut up. I fought to raise my hand, and it was more effort than anything I'd done that night. My hand shook and shook harder, but finally moved 6 inches to touch the surface of the skull in the cloth bag on my hips.
Bob!
I screamed, purely in my head, as I would have using Ebenezer's sending stone.
Hell's bells, he replied. You don't have to scream. I'm right here.
I need a shield, something to ward off his will. I figure this is a spiritual attack. A spirit should be able to counter it.
Oh, sure, but no can do from in here, boss,
Bob said.
You have my permission to leave the skull for this purpose,
I thought desperately. The skull's eye sockets glowed with orange-red light, and then a cloud of glowing energy flooded out of the eyes and rose, gathering above my head and casting warm light down around me. Seconds later, I heard Bob thinking,
Take this, shorty!
And suddenly the Red King's will was not enough to keep me down. The pain receded, smothered and numbed by an exhilarating, icy chill that left my nerves tingling with energy.
I clenched my teeth, freed from the burden of pain, and thrust my own will against his. I was a child arm-wrestling a weightlifter. But his last remark gave me some extra measure of strength, and I suddenly thrust myself to my feet. The Red King turned to face me fully again, and extended both hands toward me, his face twisting with rage and contempt. The horrible pressure began to swell and redouble. I heard his voice quite clearly when he said,
"Bow! Down, mortal!"
I took one dragging step toward my friends, then another, and another, and another, moving forward with increasing steadiness. Then I snarled through clenched teeth and said,
"Bite me, asshole!"
And I put my hand on Murphy's left shoulder. She'd already moved her hand halfway to the sword. As I touched her, touched our auras together, spreading my own defenses over hers, and felt the direct and violent strength of her own will to defy the immortal power brought against us, her hand flashed up to the hilt of Fidelacius and drew the katana from its plain scabbard. White light, like nothing that ancient stadium had ever seen, erupted from the sword's blade, a bright agony that reminded me intensely of the crystalline plain. Howls of pain rose from around us, but were drowned by Murphy's sudden, ringing cry, her voice swelling throughout the stadium and ringing off the vaults of the sky.
"False gods!"
she cried, her blue eyes blazing as she stared at the Red King and the Lords of Outer Night.
"Pretenders! Usurpers of truth! Destroyers of faith, of families, of lives, of children! For your crimes against the Mayans, against the peoples of the world, now will you answer! Your time has come! Face judgment almighty!"
I think I was the only one close enough to see the shock in her eyes, and I realized that it wasn't Murphy speaking the words, but someone else speaking them through her. Then she swept her sword in an arc, slashing the very air in front of us in a single whistling stroke. And the will of the Red King vanished. Gone. The Red King let out a scream and clutched at his eyes. He screamed something, pointing in Murphy's direction, and in the same instant the rest of my friends gasped and rocked in place, suddenly free. Every golden mask turned toward my friend.
"Bob!"
I cried. "Go with her! Keep her free!"
"Woo-hoo!"
the skull said, and gold-orange light fell from my head toward Murphy and gathered about her blonde hair, even as the joined wills of the Lords of Outer Night fell upon her, so thick and heavy that I was knocked away from her, as if by a physical force. The very air around her warped with its intensity. White light from the sword flowed down and over her, and her garments literally transformed, as if that light had flowed into them, become a part of them, turning night to day, black to white. She staggered to one knee and looked up, her jaw set in stubborn determination, her teeth bared, her blue eyes, through the distortion, blazing like fire in defiance of 13 dark gods. And, with one of the most powerful spirits I'd ever met, gathered around her head in a glowing golden halo. Murphy came to her feet with a shout and a smooth stroke of the sword. The Lords of Outer Night all reacted, jerking back as if they'd been struck a blow in the face. Several golden masks were ripped from their faces as if the blow had physically touched them, and the molten presence of their joined wills was suddenly gone. With a scream, the Jaguar warriors, half-breed and vampire alike, surged toward Murphy. She ducked the swing of a modern katana, shattered a traditional obsidian sword with a contemptuous sweep of Fidelacius, and struck down the warrior wielding it with a precise horizontal cut. But she was outnumbered, not by dozens or scores, but by the hundreds, and the Jaguar warriors immediately fanned out to come at her from several directions. They knew how to work together. But then, so did Sonya and I. Sonya came forward with Esperacius, and as it joined the fray, it too kindled into blazing white light that seemed to lick out at the vampires, forcing them to duck, to slap at white sparks that danced in their eyes. His booted foot caught one Jaguar warrior in the small of the back, and the raw power of the kick snapped the warrior's head back with force enough to break it. I followed him in,
unleashing a burst of freezing wind that took two warriors from their feet when they tried to flank Murphy from the other side. She and Sonya went back to back, cutting down Jaguar warriors with methodical efficiency for several seconds as more and more of the enemy swarmed toward them. I kept slapping them away, not able to do any real harm, but preventing them from focusing overwhelming numbers on Murph and Sonya. But I could feel the fatigue setting in now. I couldn't keep this up forever. There were quick footsteps beside me, and then Molly pressed her back to mine.
"You take that side," she said. "I'll take this one."
DJ Molly C. lifted both of her wands and turned the battle chaos to 11. Color and light and screaming sound erupted from those two little wands. Bands of light and darkness flowed around and over the oncoming Jaguar warriors, fluttering images of bright sunshine intertwining with other images of yawning pits suddenly gaping before the feet of the attackers. Bursts of sound, shrieks and clashes and booms and high-pitched sounds like feedback on steroids sent the hyper-keen senses of full vampires into overload, literally forcing them back onto the weapons of those coming behind them. Vampires staggered through the handiwork of the one-woman rave, not stopped, but slowed and stunned by the incredible field of sound and light.
"I love a good party!"
Thomas shouted merrily, and he began to dance along the edges of Molly's dance floor, his falcata whipping into the limbs and necks of the Jaguar warriors as they wobbled forward, struck down before they could recover. I didn't think anyone could have moved fast enough to catch them, but my brother evidently didn't agree. He struck down the foe as they came for us, and he threw in a few dance moves along the way. The part he borrowed from breakdancing, where a wave traveled up one arm and down the other, was particularly effective, aesthetically, when it was bracketed by his falcata beheading one vamp and his automatic blowing apart the skull of another. The pressure of numbers increased, and Thomas started moving more swiftly, more desperately, until Mouse leapt in to help plug the leak in the dam of confusion that held the full power of the Red Court at bay. I had my own side of the store to mind. Again, I reached into the well of cold, ready power, and with a word blanketed the field before me in smooth, slick ice. Howling wind rose to greet any foe who stepped out onto the ice, forcing them to work around to the killing machine that was Sonya and Murphy, or else circle around to attempt an approach through Molly's murderous light and sound show. Someone touched my arm, and I nearly roasted him without looking. Martin flinched, as though he'd had a dodge ready to go if I had something for him.
"Dresden," he called. "Look!"
I looked. Upon the little temple at the end of the ball court, the Lords of Outer Night and the Red King were standing in a circle, and they were all gathering magical power, probably from one of the bloody ley lines to boot. Whatever they were going to do, I had a bad feeling that I was reaching the very end of my bag of tricks. I heard booted feet, and saw the mortal security guards lining up along the sides of the stadium, rifles at the ready. When they were in position, they would open fire, and the simple fact was that if they piled enough rounds into us, we would go down. Who was I kidding? I couldn't keep the field of ice and wind together for very long, and I knew Molly couldn't maintain her rave at that intensity for long either. Dozens of Jaguar warriors had fallen, but that meant little. Their numbers had not been diminished by any significant measure. We could fight as hard as we wanted, but despite everything, in the end, it was going to be futile. We were never getting out of that stadium. But we had to try.
"Leah!"
I screamed.
"Yes, child?" she asked, her tone pleasant and conversational. I could still hear her perfectly clearly. Neat trick.
"The king and his jokers are about to hit us with something big."
"Oh, my, yes," the Linanshi said, looking skyward dreamily.
"So do something!" I howled at her.
"I already am," she assured me. She removed a small emerald from a pocket of her gown and flung it skyward. It sparkled and flashed and flew up out of the light of torches and swords and vanished into the night. A few seconds later, it exploded in a cloud of merry green sparks. "There. That place will do," she said, clapping her hands and bouncing up and down on her toes. "Now we shall see a real dance."
Green lightning split the sky, erupting with such a burst of thunder that the ground shook.
Instead of fading, though, the thunder grew louder as more and more strokes of lightning flared out from the area of sky where Leah's gem had exploded into light. Then a sheet of a dozen separate green bolts of lightning fell, all at the same time, onto the ground of the ball court 20 yards away, blowing smoking craters in the ground. It took my dazzled eyes a few seconds to recover from that, and when they did, my heart almost stopped. Standing on the ball court were 12 figures. 12 people in shapeless gray robes, gray cloaks, gray hoods. And every single one of them held a wizard's staff in one hand. The Gray Council. The Gray Council. The nearest figure was considerably shorter than me and stout, but he stood with his feet planted as if he intended to move the world. He lifted his staff, smote it on the ground, then boomed,
"Remember, Archangel!"
He spoke a single resonating word as he thrust the tip of the implement at the Red King and the Lords of Outer Night. The second floor of the stadium temple where they stood simply exploded. A force hit the ancient structure like an enormous bulldozer blade rushing forward at Mach 2. It smashed into the temple. Stone screamed. The Red King, the Lords of Outer Night, and several thousand tons of the temple structure were sent flying back through the air with enough violent energy to send a shockwave rebounding from the point of impact. The massive display of force brought a second of stunned silence to the field, and I was just as slack-jawed as anyone. Then I threw back my head and let out a primal scream of triumph and glee. The Gray Council had come. We were not alone. The echo of my scream seemed to be a signal, sending the rest of us back to fighting for our lives. I blew a few more vampires back, and then sensed a rush of supernatural energy coming at me. I turned and caught a tide of ruinous red power upon my shield, and hurled a blast of flame back at a red court noble in massive amounts of jewelry. Others in their ranks began to open up on the newly arrived Gray Council, who responded in kind, and the air was filled with a savage crisscross of exchanged energies. The stocky figure in gray stumped up to me and said casually,
"How you doing, Hoss?"
I felt my face stretch into a fierce grin, but I answered him just as casually,
"Sort of wish I'd brought a staff with me. Other than that, can't complain."
From within his hood, Ebenezer grunted.
"Nice outfit."
"Thanks," I said. "I liked your ride. Good mileage?"
"As long as there's some carpet to scuff your feet on," he said, and tossed me his staff. "Here."
I felt the energies moving through the implement at once. It was a better-made staff than mine, but Ebenezer had been the one to teach me how they were made. And both staves I had used over the years had been carved from branches of the lightning-struck oak in the front yard of his little farm in the Ozarks. I could make use of this staff almost as well as if it were my own.
"What about you?" I asked him. "Don't you want it?"
He batted a precisely aimed, thrown axe from the air with a flick of his hand and a word and drawled,
"I got another one."
Ebenezer McCoy extended his left hand, spoke another word, and darkness swirled from the shadows and condensed into a staff of dark, twisted wood, unmarked by any kind of carving whatsoever. The Black Staff.
"Fuego!"
shouted someone on the walls, and for a second I was hit with a little sting of insult. Someone was shouting "Fuego," and it wasn't me. While I was feeling irrational pique, guns started barking, and they aimed at me first. Bullets rang sharply as they hit my armor, rebounding from it and barely leaving a mark. It was like getting hit with small hailstones, uncomfortable but not really dangerous, unless one of them managed a headshot. Ebenezer turned toward the walls from which the soldiers were firing. Hits thumped into his robes but seemed to do little but stir the fabric and then fall at his feet. The old man said, mostly to himself,
"You took the wrong contract, boys."
Then he swept the black staff from left to right, murmured a word, and ripped the life from 100 men. They just died. There was absolutely nothing to mark their deaths. No sign of pain, no struggle, no convulsion of muscles, no reaction at all. One moment they were firing wildly down at us, and the next they simply dropped, dead.
The old man turned to the other wall, and I saw two or three of the brighter soldiers throw their guns down and run. I don't know if they made it, but the old man swept the black staff through the air again, and the gunmen on that side of the field dropped dead where they stood. My godmother watched it happen and bounced and clapped her hands some more, as delighted as a child at the circus. I just stared for a second, shocked. Ebenezer had just shattered the first law of magic, "Thou shalt not kill." He had used magic to directly end the life of another human being, nearly 200 times. I mean, yes, I had known what his office allowed him to do, but there was a big difference between appreciating a fact and seeing that terrible truth in motion. The black staff itself pulsed and shimmered with shadowy power, and I got the sudden sense that the thing was alive, that it knew its purpose and wanted nothing more than to be used as often and as spectacularly as possible. I also saw veins of venomous black begin to ooze their way over the old man's hand, reaching up slowly, spreading to his wrist. He grimaced and held his left forearm with his right hand for a moment, then looked over his shoulder and said,
"All right."
The farthest gray figure, tall and lean, lifted his staff. I saw light gleam off of metal at one end of the staff, and then green lightning enfolded the length of wood as he thrust the metal end into the ground. He took the staff back, but the twisting length of green lightning stayed. He drove the staff down again about 6 feet away, and again lightning sheathed it. Then he removed the staff, reversed his grip on it, and with a sweep of his arm drew another shaft of lightning between the two upright columns of electricity, bridging the gap. He was opening a way. There was a flash of light, and the space between the bolts of lightning warped and went dark, then exploded with black figures bearing swords. For the first moment, I thought that they were wearing odd costumes or maybe weird armor. Their faces were shaped something like a crow's, complete with a long yellow beak. They were wearing clothes that seemed to be made from feathers, and then I got it. They actually were beak-faced creatures, covered in soft black feathers and carrying swords, each and every one of them a Japanese-style katana. They poured out of the gate by the score, by the hundreds, and began to bound forward with unnaturally long leaps that seemed only technically different from flying. They looked deadly and beautiful, all grace, speed, and perfection of motion. The wild light of the one-woman rave glittered off of their blades and glassy black eyes.
"The Kenku owe me a favor," Ebenezer drawled. "Seemed like a good time to call it in."
With sharp whistles and wails of fury, the strange creatures bounded up out of the ball court and began to engage the red court in numbers. It was too much to take in. Sorcery flew beside bullets on a larger scale than anything I'd ever seen. Stone weapons clashed against steel. Blood flew, the black of the vampires, the blue of the Kenku, and mostly flashes of scarlet mortal blood. There was too much terror and incongruous beauty in it, and I think my head reacted by tuning out everything that wasn't threatening my life or was more than a few yards away. "Maggie," I said. I grabbed the old man's shoulder. "I've got to get to her." He grimaced and nodded his head.
"Where?"
"The big temple," I said, pointing at the pyramid. "And about 400 meters north of the temple, there's a trailer cattle car," I said. "It was guarded the last time I looked. There are human prisoners still in it." Ebenezer grunted and nodded.
"Get the girl. We'll take care of the Red Court and their lords."
The old man spat on the ground, his eyes alight with excitement.
"We'll see how the slimy bastards like eating what they've been dishing out."
I gripped his hand, hard, then put my other one on the old man's shoulder and said,
"Thank you."
His eyes welled up for an instant, but he only snorted and squeezed back.
"Get your girl, hoss."
The old man winked at me. I blinked a few times myself and then turned away. Time was running out. For Maggie. And for me. Chapter 47.
"Godmother!"
I shouted, turning toward the pyramid. Leah appeared at my side, her hands now filled with emerald and amethyst light, her own deadly sorcery.
"Shall we pursue the quest now?"
"Yeah, stay close. We'll round up the team and move." Molly was nearest. I went to my apprentice and shouted in her ear,
Come on! Let the birdmen take it from here. We've got to move.
Molly gave me a vague nod and finally lowered the little wands as the Kenku's charge drove into the Red Court